Okay. A lot of the hormones that regulate energy metabolism work via inducing calcium signals in the liver. And the interesting finding here is that these signals are actually coordinated across a large number of cells. So these are within one lobule, it's several hundreds, if not thousands of cells. That, I mean, it's difficult to see how far the waves go down inside, but a very large number of cells. It's a different case. Are astrocytes, although they may not be so different, and we've seen many videos, so I would like to restrict myself here to this one picture. And this is a culture of astrocytes, and these are from a particular brain region from the striatum of the rats. So this is a primary culture, so here the cell bodies. And again, you can elicit a calcium wave, and we've seen many examples in the previous slide. And this wave here is elicited by focal application of a mediator. It's not exactly a neurotransmitter in this case, but something like a neurotransmitter, and this applied to the single cell will elicit a calcium wave that actually spreads slowly through the preparation. And this picture you've seen in the talk before, and I've stolen, of course, from a paper published in Andrew Charles' lab, where they show that you can get also activity that is properly attributable to astrocytes, or primarily to astrocytes, both spontaneous and after application of a neurotransmitter to a slice culture, so in a more somewhat more physiological system. And this activity, as Andrew has pointed out, goes over much larger numbers of cells than we've seen the previous calcium wave propagate in the primary culture. So what are the kind of issues that are of interest? And then also they have been already pointed out in the previous talk. There are several pathways by which the cells could be coupled, and there's probably agreement that all these pathways will work primarily via diffusion. There's of course cytoplasmic and gap junctional diffusion, both preparations I've showed so far, so the liver as well as many regions in the brain, or many astrocytes from many regions in the brain, are well coupled by gap junctions. And we could think that mainly IP3, this is the main candidate, could be exchanged via gap junctions. Calcium is also permeable if the concentration is not too high, and there may be paracrine communication, and in both systems also we've seen very strong evidence for this in the previous talk, that there is extracellular signaling going on. And a primary candidate also in the liver is ATP for this. The next question is if we have signals, and probably this should be not calcium waves but calcium signals, but in the literature the term wave has become established also for signals you wouldn't actually call a wave from a mathematical point of view, but just for very localized signals that probably just work by diffusion. In the experimental literature, they're often also called calcium waves, so I think signal would be the better term here. The question is there a regeneration involved in these signals? To what properties does it lead? And there are two main feedbacks, and in the last talk we saw a third feedback, two main feedbacks. We looked so far at, and this is that calcium can induce its own release, but for this we need either sensitized IP3 receptors or possibly also ryanodine receptors. Or it could also be that other feedbacks are involved in this process that work via more extensive loops. For example, IP3 induced calcium release, and then calcium released could then stimulate IP3 generation by certain isotypes of phospholipase C, and we will come back to that. An interesting question, of course, is also if it's an excitable system, what are inhibitory mechanisms? Here's a very simple model, just showing some sort of basic data, or basic results such models would give. And this is when we ask the question, looking at experiments not at the whole liver level, but at isolated hepatocytes that were still coupled by gap junctions to an appreciable extent. And what we did here is just we wanted to couple two of these cells, and we took a very simple model of calcium dynamics, and we have talked about many different kinds of models and how oscillations could come about. And I would like to point out that also very simple models already give results that can account for many of the observed phenomena. And this would be a scheme of such a simple model where you only include calcium balances between the cytoplasm and the ER, and you include four types of fluxes, namely the sequestration, the release flux, and some kind of calcium leak. There could be different channels or some leaky processes across the plasma membrane, and extrusion via the plasma membrane calcium ATPase. And in this type of model, you could model all of these processes linearly. You only need one non-linearity, namely positive feedback of calcium on its own release. That's the only non-linearity you need, and you can generate oscillations with many of the properties that are actually observed in the experiment. We took a slightly more complicated model where we actually included here the more detailed properties of the IP3 receptor that is also inactivated by calcium. And what you can see in this type of model, you can generate oscillations. They have some deficiencies if you look at the actual shape when you compare them with oscillations generated, traces generated in real cells. But what is important in hepatocytes is that these oscillations show what is so-called frequency encoding. So their frequency increases with increasing dose of agonist, and all of these models reproduce this very well. And the encoding does not occur via amplitude regulation. Also, these models reproduce this very well, quite naturally. The amplitude stays constant over the whole period, over the whole oscillation period.
Sorry, in this model, where is the P?
The IP3, or what?
I mean, how is the IP3 concentration incorporated in?
The IP3 concentration is incorporated, as we've seen in many models before, just as a parameter that sets the basic fraction of channels that can be activated by calcium binding. So in this, there's no dynamics of IP3. These oscillations would be generated without feedback on any IP3 processes. Well, this is one of these rate equations in the calcium release rate. If you write down a kinetic expression for it, there would be one parameter that would account for IP3. Yes? That's for the store calcium concentration. So you make a balance in the cell for in the cytosol and in the store. And these are the two basic variables. And of course, in this model, it so happens if you have two identical cells that you couple by gap junctional fluxes. And at the time when we did this modeling, there was a big controversy. Is it calcium that goes through the gap junctions, or is it IP3 that goes through the gap junctions and does something to the oscillations? Our reasoning was, if IP3 is not a dynamic variable in these models, it cannot synchronize the cells to any extent. And this is exactly what you see in the experiments. When you have two cells, two oscillators, that they actually, when you stimulate them, that they synchronize. And when you disrupt the coupling, they show very different period, very different intrinsic period. And so our question was, can we account for the synchronization simply by fluxes of calcium through small fluxes of calcium through gap junctions? And if you have two identical cells, that's a trivial problem. You get always synchronization. The question is, what happens if the cells show different parameters and show different intrinsic periods at the same level of stimulation? And there you get a well-known phenomenon. It depends on the actually coupling permeability between the cells. So this is how well the cells can communicate via cytoplasmic calcium diffusion. And if the coupling coefficient is very small, then the events are more or less independent. I mean, if you follow this timescale for a long time, you notice no periodicity between the first cell and the broken line is the second cell. And when you increase coupling, then you see here you see that the period is about 2 to 1. You almost always see the intrinsic period, and here you actually see the phase locking at the 2-to-1 ratio, and when you increase coupling coefficient even more, then you see a 1-to-1, and this is a very well-known phenomenon. We asked ourselves, so how would the permeability that you need to achieve synchrony, because this is what is seen in these liver cell preparations, depend on the coupling coefficient? And you see a typical curve like this. That looks a little bit like an Arnold tongue for a forced oscillator. And these are many different realizations that have all been normalized to fit in here. So all these curves mean that we have very different parameters to make the cells different, and these are different basic levels of stimulation, so that we carry, go over a whole range of stimulation, and you see that you can estimate a critical kind of coupling coefficient that you observe, what you naturally observe, because periods range about from sort of in the range that is depicted here. And you get an estimate of a critical coupling coefficient, and people don't really know what the permeability of gap junctions between two hepatocytes are, but you can also try to reach some sort of via some biophysical estimates some order of magnitude calculation, and it does actually fall in what we would require to synchronize the cells. So what we conclude is that it's not at all impossible to do this mechanism. And here are just two experiments that show basic features, and that basically repeat experiments that have been done before. So the synchronization and desynchronization is very rapid. It happens within one period. This is an experiment where you have two cells that are of different intrinsic period, but they're synchronized by gap junctional coupling. If you disrupt the coupling, they immediately desynchronize. If you switch the coupling on again, which you cannot do so simply experimentally, also quickly experimentally, then they immediately resynchronize. And here it's shown that the coupling doesn't just induce an event in the neighboring cell by sort of pushing a flux of calcium from one cell to another cell, and you see an event because of the calcium that is arriving in the other cell, but it's very small effects, namely if you inhibit active calcium signaling in the second cell from this time on. Basically what we did, we switched off the release through IP3 receptors. You see that the events that actually are transmitted through the gap junctions are extremely tiny. And this is an array of three cells. And via this procedure, you can also disrupt synchrony between cells that are connected through an adjacent cell. So in this model, you would need a periodic activity in all the cells in a row. So you could not skip a cell to transmit your behavior. And exactly in this I did not note. I have not seen experimental traces where you see this. And in this simple model, you can actually prove that the primary bifurcation is always to synchrony. And we never found stable antisynchronous oscillations. They were always unstable. So that's the second set, what I would call a very simple-minded model. And here we wanted to look a little bit more in detail on the spatial propagation of the signal, because it seemed to be an important component to us in finding out what really couples cells. And what we did here, we just looked at a linear array of cells, and we wrote down a very simple equation for the calcium release, because we thought we could do some analysis on this very simple equation. This has been used repeatedly, and also by a very similar equation we have seen in the fire, diffuse fire model. Here it's in a slightly different context. What we assume here is that we have release sites of calcium, but there we assume they are continuously distributed, but we can sort of set the distribution by some function h of x, so we can actually determine where there are sources depending here. What we usually assume, there's a block of sources in the middle of the cell, and there may be gaps at the gap junction, because this is the main reason region we are interested in. And this is just a step function, so it goes up if calcium exceeds a certain threshold, so this would be calcium-induced calcium release. What we think is through sensitized IP3 receptors. The coefficient alpha would be how many sensitized receptors do we have per patch of ER membrane. Then we have resequestration of the calcium here, and cytoplasmic diffusion. And then the cells are coupled simply by passive diffusion across some pores that we think would model the gap junctions for our conditions, at least in the absence of any more information on this. I mean, this could, of course, if you knew more about the gating of the gap junction, we could make this more realistic, or maybe it is already realistic. It's hard to say with the available data at the moment. And this just means the flux across is just the permeability coefficient times the concentration difference across the gap junctions. And the idea here is to, one type of analysis you can do, you can construct when you stimulate at some cell that is far to the left here, you can stimulate the cell and you can ask yourself, will a wave propagate through the system? And to answer these questions, you can go through an exercise That means you can ask yourself whether, when you keep the stimulus, will you get a profile that will actually fall off at some at a certain point, or will you not get such a profile? And this is just illustrated here. Here we assume we have stimulated at some point here. I should actually say in this equation is of course not refractory. So in this sense, it only gives you memory where the calcium was released. The calcium, once it's released, goes to high steady state, it never goes back. So this is one, of course, limitation of this kind of approach. But what you can see here in this equation is you can say something about the leading front of your... You don't see anything about the wake.
It's element I.
Right.
How are they coupled?
By this.
So this... Only
by the boundary condition and the bound, and here's only the concentration gradient across the boundary. So that's the flux, and that's just some permeability times concentration gradient.
And each one of these elements contains many cells?
No, each one is one cell. That's what we think. This is one cell, and so on. Yeah. Okay. And now you can ask, can you propagate a wave or can you not propagate a wave? And you can answer this question by asking another question, namely when you stimulate persistently at one end, will you actually get a profile that will decay at some certain point, or will you not get such a profile? And the mathematics say if you get such a profile, then you cannot propagate a proper wave through the system because all the initial conditions will run into this profile and get stuck. And if you do not see such a profile, you can propagate waves, and the analysis can actually be done. And what you end up with can be formulated in some approximation for small diffusion coefficients in a condition for wave propagation that can be written in such a way that you say you require a certain permeability between the cells to actually propagate a wave. And this permeability depends on the intracellular parameters of your calcium system. And these are the diffusion coefficient and the calcium-induced calcium release rate, maximal rate, and the sequestration rate into the ER. And what we found interesting, but also easily understandable in a way, in this is that here the diffusion in the cytoplasmic compartment plays a detrimental role in some, to some extent, for the propagation between cells. That means if you have a high D, you require high permeability between the cells, while if you only have a low permeability between the cells, you can still propagate waves if your D is sufficiently low. And this highlights that the process really is a regenerative process, because what this says is what you really need is you need to excite with your messenger that comes through, and in this case it's calcium, you need to excite something in a range near to the gap junctions, and it's detrimental if the messenger diffuses too much, because then you cannot reach a sufficient threshold concentration near the gap junctions. So this also does not really argue against calcium as being gap junction messenger, because calcium will probably stay very well localized here when it goes through the gap junctions. So then we asked, what kind of properties would such signals have? And this is of interest, and this has already been pointed out by Andrew in the previous talk. We often see, and this was one puzzling observation to us, we often see intercellular waves that are of finite spatial extent, but go a long distance before they fail. And I will come back to this point a little bit later. So we asked the question, so what do actually, you can get either a wave, and you get a wave if the system is permeable enough. And if you do not get a wave, what do you get? And this is what is answered in this slide. What we've shown here is, we showed how regenerative is the system, so how sensitive are the IP3 receptors, it increases in this way, and how permeable are the gap junctions. And what you see is when you plug into the simple system estimates that would be characteristic of your calcium system, especially of your intracellular calcium diffusion, then you see binary behavior. You either get signals that get stuck in the stimulated cell and do not propagate at all, or you get signals that propagate through the whole system. And of course, in this system, you would need agonist, if you think about this, applied to all the cells homogeneously. You need to bath the cells in the agonist. However, if you have different diffusive properties of the messenger, and here we plugged in the typical values you find for IP3, that's about an order of magnitude more diffusive effectively in the cytoplasm, at least according to what people have reported from the...
So that's a different model, where IDP diffuses,
I will come back to this question. So what we here thought is the feedback loop, I mean, the model we used is a very contracted model. So we could also think there is some positive feedback loop via IP3, and is really IP3 diffusion carrying it through the gap junctions. And we just thought as if...
What did you do in the model to distinguish between these two?
Nothing. We just said the variable C that we showed before is what we initially thought is calcium. And then we thought, okay, we just think also IP3 could be involved in positive feedback loop. So it could be regenerated, it's degraded, and it's diffusing. So we can put all these three parameters we have in the model here.
So all you changed was D.
For IP3? Well, we changed K also a little bit, because we know what the IP3 in these cells is, but this is not very different. So what we mainly change is D, and this is an order of magnitude larger in the right-hand side diagram. And what you see here is that you have a similar behavior. You get a border where you go from finite signals to traveling waves, but this is for a particular range of stimulation. So the left-hand side is held at a particular point. I mean, this will change when you change the boundary condition on the left-hand side. This is only to illustrate that you can actually achieve signals, and this is not very surprising, that go a certain way before they fail. So this means that you can actually, if your system is permeable enough, you can actually excite a number of cells before your signal fails. So depending on the diffusivity, you get either all or none behavior, or you get a smooth kind of graded approach to until you actually propagate the waves. In this diagram, of course, you have all these regions as well, but they all sit in between here, so they're probably not accessible.
I guess modeling the decay of IP3, that's probably a reasonable way to do it. The more IP3 you have, the faster it decays. But the pumps will saturate because you only have so many pumps to bind. So I don't. Mm. You might think about putting in
Hill-type.
A cartoon-like function that will saturate.
Yeah. That's actually a good suggestion. I mean, put in a linear function here, just we want to do the analysis, of course.
And it will change the results.
Probably that's a good suggestion, actually. One thing before I go to more detailed models I want to point out is that even with the simple models, you can get some initially quite unexpected phenomena. When we did this, we read some papers where people looked at communication of different cell types, and unlike Andrew Charles's work, where he looked at vasculature and, astrocytes that have bidirectional calcium communication, there are certain instances where people say that you can have calcium waves in one cell type, calcium waves in the other cell type, and from one cell type A, for example, will propagate into cell type B, but not the other way around. And there may be many explanations, but with this simple model, you would get plenty of freedom to sort of make up such situation. This is shown here, just in the situation here. And what is done here is that we have different buffering of the calcium in the cytoplasm, so we have different diffusion coefficients. And in the cell type B, the diffusion coefficient is higher, so the buffering could be expected to be lower. And we need to make up for this with the higher permeability between the B cells, so they will conduct waves. And this is shown here. If I start with the B cells, they will conduct waves from this side. And the A cells will also conduct waves. This is shown here. The white is the high calcium. But now when you come from A to B or B to A, you're in a different situation. And one time, you inject the signal through a low permeability gap junction in the cell where it diffuses very rapidly. And this is this situation. And here, you will not excite the B-type cells. While you come from this direction, you will actually excite the cells. So all this shows is that there are plenty of possibilities to explain such a behavior beyond actual differences in morphology or something of the cell. So now I want to come back to our work on astrocytes, where we actually attempted to make a more detailed model on how these waves could propagate, and these are data by Christian Guillaume and one of his students, Nathalie Roache. And these data just show this is an astrocyte culture, this is a co-culture with neurons. And what it's done here is injected a dye in the central cell, and you see the dye actually that injected is injecting the cytoplasm propagates. This is just an illustration that the cells are coupled by gap junctions. And these are particular, as I said, the astrocytes from a particular brain region, and this may not be uniform property and may depend very well on the region where the astrocytes are expressed. An indication is already coming from here that namely when you just take the astrocytes without the neurons, the dye coupling is much less in this situation. So the neurons could regulate properties of the astrocyte signaling just by actually being there. And what Christian also showed is that this is actually dependent on the activity, functional activity of the neurons. This is just a reminder of what we want to model. And although I'm not an experimentalist, I need to just very briefly go into the mechanisms we think participate in these types of waves. And here I try to emphasize that there's a lot of heterogeneity in the preparations, which I do not fully understand, whether it comes from how the labs actually prepare the cultures or whether it really comes from the source of the astrocytes. But in this preparation that is coming from the red striatum, the properties, well, two important properties are the following. Namely, the first is, and this is not so surprising, that this is shown here, the range of the wave, that you can apply certain inhibitors of certain processes. And if you inhibit IP3, induce calcium release, or ER, calcium, then you get no calcium waves in these cells. So depend on IP3-induced calcium liberation from the endoplasmic reticulum. You can also show that blockers of ryanodine receptors do not do anything to the waves. And this is one of the agents that is thought to block gap junctions. And well, it probably does block gap junctions, but probably blocks also a number of other things. And in this case, you see that you actually abolish the waves by a treatment that seems to, the treatment is known to block gap junctions between the cells, but possibly also, this I don't know, release of signals through connexin channels in the plasma membrane. There's further experiments done here, and I've not shown, they're done with ATP degrading enzyme in the extracellular space and with perfusion flow. And unlike the experiments we saw in the previous talk, they do not generate any difference to the waves. So you can actually induce perfusion flow and the wave will look the same, and you can degrade ATP extracellularly, and you can also block glutamate receptors, and the waves will look the same. An interesting observation is here on the right side, and this is hinting a little bit whether there's regeneration in the system involved or not, because I have to emphasize the hormone that mobilizes calcium in this case is applied only locally to a single cell. So even if you assume that it diffuses a little bit, cells further downstream will probably not, very likely not see any of the hormone. So they will not generate any IP3 by external signaling. So this is ruled out very well by the experiments. And what is shown here is that you can generate IP3 by another means, namely simply by calcium, raising calcium levels in the cell. And this is done here by calcium ionophore and looking at the production of IP phosphates in the cell, inositol phosphates in the cell. And this increases when you're inject calcium, when you increase calcium influx into the cell, and you can inhibit this increase when you inhibit phospholipase C. So this hints towards a possible role of calcium activation of phospholipase C, and there's also a structural equivalent coming from studies of other groups that have shown that the under physiological calcium levels most sensitive isoform of phospholipase C, the response to calcium differences in the physiological range is phospholipase C delta, and this is strongly expressed in the astrocyte fraction if you fractionate certain regions of the brain. So this is what I've pointed out before, is we can need IP3 mediated calcium release. We have a calcium activation of IP3 generation possibly through phospholipase C delta, and in this preparation it seems to rely on actual gap junctional coupling between the cells. And when you look at the waves that you induce in primary cultures, what you see is that they're of limited spatial extent. And what you typically see, this is an amplitude picture here, that this is just one picture for mechanical, but it also looks for hormonal stimulation, looks the same. You see a decrease over the first few cells. And you see more or less of a settling over a certain time. And this is done in sort of what are more or less defining concentric rows of cells around the region of stimulus. So that would be stimulated cell first, second, third, and so on, row of cells. And then abruptly at a certain point, the waves will fail. And this is quite reproducible, this range of waves. And this is shown here. It's quite reproducible. And it's shown the number of responding cells for a number of experiments. And what's shown here is that it depends on the potency of the agonist to elicit a calcium response in the stimulated cell. So there are some agonists that show very little response. Glutamate shows intermediate response. Then we have a somewhat higher response here for other agonists. And for ionomycin, we have very high response, and mechanical stimulation isn't shown here. And if you block gap junctions, then you get no significant calcium wave. So these are some of the data we would like to explain in the model. And this is our picture of what calcium signaling would look like in these cells. And we have, at least in the stimulated cell, we can activate calcium signaling by a receptor agonist that will produce IP3. IP3 will release calcium. Calcium will feedback positively and negatively on its own release. So there's a positive feedback on receptor inactivation. We also included exchange with the extracellular medium just to get signals that look more like the experimental signals. You can show that this, both experimentally and you also see this in the model, that the influx from the extracellular medium plays a negligible role for wave propagation. So you could also sort of leave out these two terms. And the important point here is that we have a means of regeneration of the signal, namely calcium can activate the production of IP3. And we don't know what happens in the intercellular diffusion. IP3 probably goes through gap junctions very well. That has been shown by many studies. But we also accounted for the possibility that calcium goes through. And one way of analyzing the model will also be to decide which role these particular or which share these two substances have in actually carrying calcium wave to neighboring cells. So we can write down balance equations, and our four variables turn out to be, these are very fast processes at the receptor here. IP3 is a variable on this time scale. We look at calcium, of course, because the signal we measure. The receptors are also through the inactivation on a sort of appreciable time scale. And to complete the calcium balance in the cell, we also need to account for the ER calcium in the cell. And you can write balance equations that contain all these fluxes. We focused on a two-dimensional spatial domain simply by reasoning that the cells in the cell culture are flat, monolayer of cells. The cells themselves are pretty flat. And we have the same kind of boundary conditions between the cells now in a two-dimensional array.
Is the IP3?
A little p here, yeah, is the IP3.
And it diffuses.
It diffuses.
The cytosolic calcium also.
It also diffuses. And
the ER calcium is the?
The ER calcium, we didn't.
Is that the ER?
That's the S in the stores. This is the ER. We put diffusion, small diffusion in here. It makes no difference to the wave propagation. R is the fraction of receptors that can be opened that are not inactivated. And they're fixed on the membrane. They don't move in our. And they both cytosolic calcium and IP3 can go between cells. And with a model of this kind is, of course, the question we can now look at. We can now derive reasonable terms for all these rates here, how they depend on the concentrations in the system. And we choose to make it as simple as we could. So we included only three nonlinear terms. All the other terms we assumed are just mass actions, so we do not account for saturation in these terms. So we just put a nonlinear term for calcium release. This is akin to this gives the same response as the Young-Kaiser model would give, but this is a fit that you can find in Betz-Provzani's paper on the. So this is actually what he fits to his steady state data, this function here. And we account also for receptor inactivation on a certain scale, and we chose to use a form that agrees with this kind of hill type fit. But basically, the behavior of activation and inactivation is very similar to what you would find quantitatively in the Young-Kaiser model. And the synthesis of IP3, we also assume that there's some synthesis that at least in the stimulated cell, but not in the downstream cells, comes from activating the receptor. So this will be actually time-dependent stimulus we give, that we just say that this is depending on the agonist and the receptor dynamics in the cell. And we have some idea this will be on a second scale, will activate and then probably inactivate. And then we have activation through calcium. And what you usually can find from experiments, because these are steady state data quite well, are these half saturation constants, and there are some experimental estimates also for this enzyme, what the half saturation constant is. What you cannot reasonably find are the maximal velocities and the rate constants that sit here. And so we tried to, as best as we could, to actually determine these parameters from experiments. And here it's shown how we did it. We did it in a rather simple-minded way, but what we thought would be reliable information from the experiments, what we had were traces of typical calcium responses in the cells. And what we also had were a set of experiments that I never quite understood why Laurent did them, but they were very good for fitting the model. For example, this here is a record of store emptying after withdrawal of external calcium. So what is done here, the external calcium is taken away, and at certain points, these are always different cells, one has looked with Tapsigargin how much calcium is left in the stores. And this is basically how much can you still release with Tapsigargin as a measure of how empty the stores become. That may not be a very good measure, but it at least gives you a time scale of how fast the emptying of the stores proceeds. So we have basically a number of informations. We have a rise time, we have a mean decay time of the signal, we have an amplitude of the signal, and we have a decay time under different circumstances, which we can also easily account for by the model. And we took the simplest version of the model. We took all the IP3 stuff away, and this is just calcium now. We also took away the receptors, just assumed the receptors open and close again, and then you get a piecewise linear, and with some time constant we leave open. So this should just mimic activation and delayed inactivation of the receptors. So you get a piecewise linear system which you can solve exactly, and you don't even need to solve it. You can calculate characteristic times for the different transients, and you can also calculate some analytical expression for the amplitude. And from this you can actually determine all the basic time constants here for the circa pump, for the plasma membrane pump, for the maximum calcium release flux, and also for the ratio of ER and cytoplasm effective volumes in these cells. So some of the main parameters we actually tried to adjust as good as we could to the experimental time scales. The nonlinearity sits in V release. That's here, and I just induce a calcium signal like this, and I have a time scale of inactivation in here. It's just a very simple-minded way, but we wanted to get some parameters where we thought these are defendable in terms of experimental data. You can do it probably more sophisticated, but then you get into problems, what kind of data do you have, and how do you account for the noise in the data, and so on. Is that understandable? Okay. So this system is actually forced, so there's no real nonlinearity. I force it from the outside, but maybe we can talk about it later. So, okay, this is just to show that we get a list of parameters. And maybe this I can also skip this, just to show that we get reasonable calcium responses that may be agonist-specific. So you get, this is the curve that is of interest. You get, depending on receptor density, you get different maximal amplitudes of your calcium signal, and you actually titrate a range that you see in the experiments. And this is for receptor agonists like carbachol that give very, very localized signals, and this is for receptor agonists like glutamate and also ionophore application that give much larger signals. And this is what you would see in the model if you can entirely cut off regeneration. So this basically corresponds to models that James Sneed and Mike Sanderson did a long time before we even started thinking about this. And what you would see here, you stimulate a central cell, and you see a very localized signal. This is entirely carried by diffusion of IP3, and what you see is also that the calcium signal dies down in a very graded fashion. And when you go outside from the stimulated cell to the next cells. And for the parameter estimates we put in here, this is a very meager signal that doesn't correspond at all to what you see for a normal potent agonist application in the experiments. If you put in some more regeneration, so what we do now, we increase the concentration of the enzyme or the activity of the enzyme phospholipase C-delta that produces IP3 upon calcium stimulation, of course you get a potentiation of the release, and you see typical features, for example, that your system really seems looking like propagating, looks like propagating a wave, and you see activity dying down in the center while you still propagate the wave and so on. But of course, but what we found to our quite a little bit to our surprise is that the signal actually dies down at a certain fixed distance. And here I show only where the action is. So the field of integration was much larger, was about four times what I show here. So this is no boundary-induced effect. The boundaries are a long way away from where we are. And when we monitor numerically, we see no change at the boundaries. So this is really the waves, although I put in some regeneration die out. And if you look at the amplitude behavior, you see that the amplitude behavior quite well matches what you see with respect to calcium in the experiment. And also you see this abrupt failure at a certain distance in these types of. So the regeneration has some effect, but it doesn't at all produce waves that move through the system. I think in Mike Sanderson's state, these are data, so I'm not sure whether any model shows that yet. And we discussed oscillations quite a bit, and in this particular preparation, they're not very prevalent, so you see only one out of 20 cells or something that shows a little baseline oscillation. So in this particular case, we didn't look at oscillations at all. And it is, of course, possible to change parameters in such a way that the model can generate oscillations, either decaying or self-sustained oscillations. But this we didn't study here, simply because the data we thought wouldn't give any background for judging what we got. So now we wonder, is this a general feature of the model, and did we just stumble by accident on some parameter region? Where these kind of waves look very much like what you see in the experiment and show this kind of finite range characteristic. And what we thought, we should vary the two most important parameters in the system, namely the impar parameter that determines regeneration of the signal, and this is the activity of this calcium-activated phospholipase C, and the parameter that determines how well the cells communicate intercellularly, so how well they're coupled by gap junctions in this case. And when you do this, you find three types of signals. You find what we've seen before in the very simple-minded model. You find a hard transition between what we would call regenerative, fully regenerative waves. So these are of infinite range if the system doesn't limit them by boundary conditions. And you find a transition to what we would call limited regenerative signals. But then you could also ask, if I stimulate with a certain intensity, at which point do I stop to see any difference to the purely diffusive case? So at which point does the regeneration make no difference anymore because it's too tiny? And you see that you get a second region, and this is of course no real hard boundary. This depends also on the level of stimulation, but we did for many stimulations, you see a very similar boundary in these cases. And you can actually delineate three regions that are not small by judging what kind of parameter ranges you see here. And in these three regions, you get different signals, diffusive-like signals. In the regenerative region, you of course get regenerative waves, and what you see here are intercellular spiral waves that extend over many, many cells. So these would be probably of the order of hundreds of cells. And in the intermediate region, you get these signals that are carried a long way by regeneration, but then typically fail at particular a distance from the origin of the stimulus. We now try to compare this a little bit more to between theory and experiment, and you see that in the case that we've been before, this is this case here, you get a high sensitivity for our parameters, of course, high sensitivity of the number of stimulated cells to the stimulus that initiates the wave, and this is what you see here in this experiment, although this should be turned around, so the number of cells should be here, and this is the calcium signal in the stimulated cell. While if you just appear in the diffusive case, we do not see a similar kind of sensitivity, but of course this is just some agreement that needs to be tested much further. If you now look at the impact of the different parameters in the model, and we chose a number of parameters that we know are prominently implicated in calcium signaling and that have been also varied in some of the experiments, at least in this one and in the next slide, we looked at what happens if I change the activity of this enzyme, so what do the waves look like, and of course, as we saw before, you can generate a transition. The wave range becomes larger and larger the more regeneration you get, and there's a finite transition to a region where the waves have no defined range anymore, they go any way you like. And the same happens for the activity of the calcium pump. In this case, this is the case because the Zerkai activity actually leads to filling of the stores, so the more you fill the stores, the more potent your calcium signal will be. So if you overexpress it, we would predict you could get the waves ranging much further. And somewhat to our surprise, we found that this wouldn't happen with the gap junctions. The gap junctions are, of course, permissive. If there are no gap junctions, the wave will go no way. But you cannot get the similar transition, at least in the main region here. So if you're in this region down here, increasing the gap junctions will give you not a transition between limited regenerative to regenerative waves. So you can overexpress gap junctions as you like, this prediction would say, but you would never increase, you would always increase the wave range, but at a certain expression level of gap junctions would saturate. Simply, you could not push the signals to become infinite. And in sort of pictorial terms, it would simply mean the regeneration of the signal is not strong enough for this. And what we also try to model is this is just an illustration. Of the role of gap junctions, of course, that they're permissive is because if you, this is very clear, we just tried to see whether we could get this effect, and it turned out that the gap junctions would be the best parameter that got us this effect. What you typically see in these culture experiments is that you have preferred directions of propagation, and what we did here, we just distributed gap junctions with a certain distribution that came out from the experiment, so the experimental data I did not show, but we did actually measure all along, did measure many gap junctional contacts between the cells, and we got a distribution of how these contacts were distributed between different cell cell contacts. When you just plugged in this distribution, you got a similar picture, and there's also indication that this could be the right kind of dependence, because in some of the data I showed at the very beginning, when you co-culture neurons and astrocytes, you get enormous increase in gap junction expression in the astrocytic compartment, and you get an increase in the range of calcium waves, but you never see waves that range, that go through the whole cell culture, or that have extremely large wave ranges. There's a last slide we tried to do a simulation with the model, which at that time we did not know that anyone would have done an experiment like this, and this is just a repeated stimulation of the system, and in some sense it's an excitable system, and we asked, so how long would it take before an area in the system would recover, and we measured this by recovery of the range of the wave, and you see if you give a stimuli very close after one another, you get a slight potentiation of the range, so waves go a little bit further. And then you get a deep dip and it recovers. And what we found is actually it recovers with a half time of about 5 minutes. This is quite different to what Andrew actually said in the last, in his talk. And so this would mean you would get the same result only when you wait for about 10 to 12 minutes. But we talked to Helmut Kettenmann in Berlin, and they actually did some experiments of this kind, and they essentially corroborated this result, at least in their slices, in their brain slices, they needed to wait on this order of magnitude to get a full calcium response. And this picture just shows that this is mainly determined by the refilling of the ER. So what sets the long time scale of the refractoriness is here that the cells need to refill their ER to an appreciable state. At least that's the case in the model. Whether this is really true in the experiment remains to be seen. However, this gives, of course, some conclusion. If this is true, then this would give some idea on a typical time scale on which repeated calcium signaling in the astrocytic compartment could happen. And of course, this is already the activation time scale is much slower than for neurons. The time scale of repetitive activity is even slower. The last two or three slides, I would just like to show some of the things we've just been getting into recently. And this is done together with Andrew Thomas and mainly looking at work in hepatocytes. And it addresses a point from a slightly different angle Martin raised yesterday. Maybe the question here that underlies this is, again, the question Martin told us yesterday is the range of long period oscillations. And in the hepatocytes, it seems even more dramatic than what you see in Xenopus oocytes. You get enormous period ranges from whatever 20-second period oscillations to 10-minute oscillations. And it's been very hard to account for this with a simple receptor inactivation model, although it has to be said that you can have infinite period bifurcations in these models. So it's not entirely to be ruled out in a deterministic picture. You can actually get, at least in a very small parameter range, get up to very long periods by saddle node bifurcations to a periodic to a homoclinic cycle, for example. The experiments in Andrew's lab, however, point out that the situation may be much more complex, and that it's not only calcium that determines the period with which it cycles, but there are complex interactions with IP3, and that IP3, in fact, is a dynamic player in this process. And this, of course, has been a long-standing debate, and there are some interesting new data that feed into this. And some of these data would suggest that, at least in some cell types, there is a significant negative effect of calcium on IP3, so that's exactly the opposite of what I've shown before. And this would consist in an activation of the IP3 of one of the IP3 metabolizing enzymes. And so you could have a negative feedback loop, IP3 releasing calcium, but then calcium leading to a faster metabolization of IP3 itself. And of course, this could be a negative feedback that may also create an oscillator by itself, namely negative feedback oscillator. And then you could ask the question, so what would happen? Why does it not work? What would happen if you now include into this kind of model what we already know about how calcium oscillators could function? So would a rather complex system. So what kind of behavior would this give? Essentially, you have two mechanisms that could function as an oscillatory mechanism. If they were used in isolation, what would they do if you put them together? And what we found, a little bit to our surprise, is that they don't very much interfere. You actually see what you would think, namely that with this oscillator, depending on the typical lifetime of IP3, which we hope we can estimate in some of these cells, you could get a negative feedback oscillator. And this here is, the stimulus. This would be the activity of PSC delta, so that could be read as a hormonal stimulus, for example. And within a certain stimulus range, you get oscillations that would be purely based on the blue feedback mechanism. If you now get the red feedback mechanisms, you would also get oscillations, and you would get a Hopf bifurcation curve, leaving out the blue mechanism that looks, although this is not correct. If you add this and this mechanism, then you get a range of oscillations that keeps the old oscillation range and gets larger. And what is here is the inactivation constant of the recovery from inactivation, the time scale of recovery from inactivation for the IP3 receptor. And you see that you need a certain lengthy recovery time of a few seconds to generate, to widen the oscillatory range by this feedback mechanism. So that if you have both feedback mechanisms present, It looks as if we could actually extend the range, the oscillatory range, the oscillatory response to lower agonist doses here. And if you now ask what effect this has on the period, it has exactly the effect one would desire from experiments. You can actually get long period, very long period oscillations together with very short period oscillations. And this is just illustrated here. Oops. And this is the range of periods that's seen in hepatocytes when you simulate one single, you can stimulate one single cell with different agonist doses. A little bit probably exaggerated, but it hits the right order of magnitude. So it can get very slow oscillations. So to analyze this phenomenon a little bit further, we ask, so how much do these different oscillatory regimes depend on the time scales of the different processes? We already saw that to get these kind of oscillations, you need a critical recovery time, a critically slow recovery of the IP3 receptor from inhibition. And we also know that in such negative feedback oscillators, you need a certain delay for the negative feedback to function. And we can define several characteristic times, namely the time on which IP3 moves in the system. That will be defined basically by its decay rate. And the IP3 receptor recovers from inhibition. This is our second characteristic time. And we can also just define a characteristic time for the calcium changes by coordinately changing the rate constants of release and resequestration. And again, what you see here in this is what you might expect, although it's not as clear cut as one would like. This is the fractional change of period that you would induce in the system by changing one of these characteristic times. And what you see, for example, for the characteristic time of IP3, it goes like this. So the effect on the period is the largest of the IP3 timescale. Turnover timescale is the largest for the slow period oscillation, becomes relatively small for the high period oscillation, for the low period oscillation, for the, this is the large, the slow oscillation, and this is the fast oscillation. And while the timescale of the IP3 receptor goes down in the same manner, so it does play relatively little role for the slow oscillations, but plays a lot of role for the fast oscillations. And the calcium timescale does not do something we can easily interpret. The direction of this is, of course, that we now want to try to actually manipulate the system and actually manipulate these timescales. And one way to do is via IP3 buffers. And here I have to say that I do not understand the experimental results we have so far sufficiently to actually show some of the data. And I would like to thank you for your attention at this point.